when you diagnose a problem yourself, there's a temptation that you're going to keep doing the same thing over and expecting a different outcome. And that's where the problem begins, because now you're operating in the world of insanity.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend without buying any ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Darren Cherry from Focus CFO to talk about his business and his practice and how he manages the exit planning group within Focus CFO. So Focus is a group of about 200 fractional CFOs, largely based in the US, I believe. And we're going to hear a bit about one of our favorite topics here is how to exit your business and be happy at the end of it, which is the last part is the hard part, as I'm starting to understand. So Darren, thank you very much for coming along today. Maybe you could kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Thanks, James. I'm glad to be here. Telling you something about me that you may not know. I practice something called adult meditation. You know what adult meditation consists of, James?
I'm a little bit afraid right now. Tell me. I have no idea.
It is me enjoying my favorite adult beverage, which is bourbon, accompanied by my favorite cigar.
Very good. I was worried we were going to go all woo-woo for a second there, but that's the type of meditation that I can get behind. So if you're a newbie, right, what would you start with in terms of a bourbon to get going? Because obviously we have whiskey over here, Irish whiskey. Maybe we'll swap. I'll give you an Irish whiskey to try and you give me a bourbon. What would you recommend?
You know, bourbon is a funny drink, and that is different folks have different taste. For me, I tend to gravitate towards bourbons that are made out of the Buffalo Trace Distillery, which is a wide variety, you know, anywhere from Blanton's E.H. Taylor to Buffalo Trace itself. So that's sort of my go-to and the one that I recommend to most folks to try.
Okay. Well, I'm going to swap. I'm going to give you, not that you don't have to take it up, but I recommend Redbreast, which is it's a pot distilled whiskey. It's one of the smaller brewers here based in Ireland. Everyone's familiar with Jameson and so on, but Redbreast is smaller. And they have two that I'm familiar with, the 12 and the 15, the 15-year-old aged and the 12. The 12 is actually my favorite. It's cheaper, but it's actually slightly nicer. So after this, because the tariffs have just come on here today as we're recording, we should straight away run out and grab a bottle before they have to order more new stock in, because last time I'll probably be able to afford that bourbon you recommended, so we can get to it. All right. So we like to make sure that we take the creme de la creme onto the Gross Profits podcast. You really have to know your stuff in order to be able to come onto the show. So we're going to start off with credibility and maybe a little bit of your backstory on, you know, how did you get into becoming a finance leader? How did you get started?
How did I get started? Wow. I suppose my journey began many years ago at Purdue University down in West Lafayette, Indiana. At that time, I started out wanting to be a financial analyst, specifically analyzing public companies. And somehow I transformed from that and became more interested in manufacturing and accounting for manufacturing. And that's sort of where I started from, although I must admit, I probably spent an equal amount of time in accounting and finance as I did in operations. So I sort of led on one path, led me up to being a CFO, and the other half led me up to being a CEO.
That's interesting, because as I'm an operator, obviously, and eventually one day I have this sort of dream. I don't know if it's real, but like, oh, eventually I'll just have so much in my investments that I'll be an investor. And then that's going to be, life is going to be far better for me somehow, I think. It'll be less hassle, less people involved. I can just have a nice little neat spreadsheet and I can track the numbers and then I can, you know, do what I want. So being in investments seems like a nicer or an easier life. Is that true or false? Was it harder or easier for you comparing the two worlds?
James, the one thing I never do is profess that someone's role is easier than what I do. All I know is I was just more attracted to it. And that stayed the same even after I got my MBA from the Ohio State. I continued in that path of operating and improving businesses and enterprises.
So in that career, which maybe you can give us a hint, I don't want to age you, but you can tell us how long you've been in business. What's been your biggest commercial success, the thing you hang your hat on that has been kind of the thing you're proudest of in your career so far?
You know, I think my biggest commercial success is being able to transition successfully from finance accounting into operations. I can remember operating a business that we bought out of bankruptcy. And I think it was probably 7 years later or so that business was valued of over $50 million. And wow. So it was the success of that business, but it was also the confirmation that, hey, maybe I do belong in operations.
Right. So I'm interested in that. So mindset, first of all, buying a bankrupt business seems terrifying. When you're buying anything in life, I guess you want a nice version of it, right? You want the one that's operating, the one that's working. But buying secondhand and broken is not my style. If you imagine, it just seems terrifying. So who had the guts to decide, okay, I'm going to start to look for a business?
Yeah, it wasn't as terrifying as you might believe. So our company bought it for a reason, and that was nothing to do with the business I ran. The business I ran was sort of a byproduct, but our business was practicing acquisition strategy where we wanted to consolidate the market. It just so happens that this business that manufactured a product very similar to the one we manufactured, which was steel drums and plastic drums, just ended up going bankrupt. The business that I took over, though, was not the steel drum making business. It was the chemical and lubricant packaging business.
Okay. And was that group profitable? And basically, you just had to keep the wheels running. Was that it? Or was there a turnaround required?
The reasons they went into bankruptcy was the things that we had to fix. We had to make a higher quality product, and we had to sell it to customers that valued that higher quality.
Interesting. So what I hear there is pricing was their problem. Was that part of that?
I'd never say pricing was the solution. I would merely say aligning it with companies that value what you offer. So you have to understand there are some clients that don't make a good customer for you. And that's true in any industry, and it was especially true in industrial manufacturing that we were doing. So, you know, depending on what product you were putting in the drum, dependent on kind of indicated to the market how valuable the drum was. And the more valuable the product is, the more valuable it is for you to have a reliable container to put it in. So I think it was more of improving the quality and matching with the right customers that wanted that higher level product.
Very interesting. So you have to tell us something about what you were putting in the drums before versus after. Was there a dramatic difference? What made the difference?
Well, in some cases, you know, you may have had mild washing detergent, or you may have had something that if it got out, it wasn't expensive to clean up. Whereas you may have had something that was very expensive to clean up. So you may have had an acid that you were putting in that product, in that container, or it may have been some MDI, TDI type of products where the cleanup of them is significantly high. And so you are more concerned with having a product that doesn't leak, or you may have a very expensive pharmaceutical product. So you are concerned with sure that there's no contaminants in that package before you put your product in there.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, use some acronyms there. I'm not familiar. What's MDI or TDI?
Best way to think of that family of products is, you know, the foam that's in the dashboard of your automobile?
Yeah.
That starts as a liquid. You add water to it and poof.
Right.
It expands, you know, something like 50 to 1 or so.
Wow. Okay. All right. And that's what an MDI is.
That is correct.
Okay. So if that, okay, I can see how that gets out, you're in trouble. So Interesting. Okay, very good. And can I ask there a little bit, how did that business, well, was there any, what was the root cause of that business getting into insolvency in the first place? Was it a, did they raise too much, or was it a finance error, or was it just a marketing error? Like you say, they were targeting the wrong people.
No, I think they were targeting the right people because of the quality of their product. I just don't think that market segment could survive long term having a low quality product and a low cost product.
Okay. All right. So
and the reason is it can't survive because it is now competing with a recycled product.
Oh, so the market changed. Was that it? A new, a cheaper product came in?
Yeah. So the recycled product became more prevalent. Therefore, it was competing in many cases with a recycled drum as opposed to a new drum.
Very good. And this experience, was this something before you became an entrepreneur? I guess you were working as part of a corporate structure and you were brought in there as part of a whole bigger deal. Was that the idea?
That's right. I spent, to date myself, probably 30 years working in larger Fortune 500 companies.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about where you are now when it comes to exit planning, your specialism for, entrepreneurs. So typically, you know, fractional CFOs work with companies between, you know, 2 and 10 million or so in revenue. Is that where you sit in terms of your ideal customer?
You know, our customers may range anywhere from pre-revenue to 100 million.
Wow.
Our sweet spot, however, is going to typically be somewhere between 1 million and 30 million.
So I've had a discussion this morning because the interesting position that you're in as a trusted advisor is that you're able to see a number of different types of businesses, which always fascinates me. You know, I'm deep in one business and I always wonder what's happening everywhere else. And you're in a trusted position to be able to see these different. So I have a question, which is across all of those customers, you know, the people who've done really well versus the people who haven't, there's a debate, which is, you know, frequently the sort of acquisition playbook is you buy out a company, you put in a professional management team, you improve the quality of the management team, as often frequently talked about. And then, you know, that's how you create value in that company. At the same time, I've heard from a friend of mine who's involved in an incubator program in Dublin, you know, he's seen teams from startup companies which have been very successful. And I asked him, what's the common piece, you know? And I say, is it the team? And he says, well, you know what? I wish I could say that the best teams get the best outcomes, but sometimes mediocre teams get seemingly unfair outcomes, you know, really. What's your take on that? Like, is it the best team that always wins? Or what's your opinion, having seen all these different businesses?
It's a great question, James, but let me sort of clarify something, and that is clients come to Focus CFO for one of three reasons. In some cases, they may be incredibly unhealthy, so they look to us to help them turn their business around. In other cases, they are growing quite rapidly. They're outgrowing their architecture, their infrastructure. You will hear things like, boy, we're growing so fast, the wheels are falling off the cart. And so, you know, our CFOs have experience with a broad variety of architectures, infrastructures that are needed. So we can help them plot, not do what they need in terms of people, process, and infrastructure for today, but also for the future of where they'd like to go. And then the third leg of that journey is where folks are saying, hey, eventually I want to take some chips off the table. So I want to transition my business. I want to sell my business. It could be something of that magnitude, but it is realizing the value associated with the business. And that's the third reason that typically businesses come to us. And so going back to your question, it's interesting. I can't, you know, on the one hand, I can say these are the attributes I see in people that are more successful. But are you asking specifically about successfully exiting?
Very good question. I mean, let's define success, right? So some people want to grow a business that you can pull off profits, make a good living, what is sometimes derogatively talked about as a lifestyle business, and they see that as success. And other people see it as a 50 million exit and nothing less, you know? So yeah. Let's go for the latter, because that's the popular, right? That's the TechCrunch one. That's the popular one. People who go for a big exit, how much does team really matter?
So it's, yes, team matters. But the first thing that matters is the entrepreneur themselves. And to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to have a couple rules that you hold true and dear to. And number one is you have to have a short memory. Learn from failures, not relish in them.
Right.
Get very used to no. When you're selling, when you're getting financing, you're going to get more no's. And so if you're sensitive and don't take no, then you shouldn't be an entrepreneur. The other issue is you have to be coachable, willing to learn, and always try to hire people smarter than you. See, when you hire people that are not smarter than you, then you become the limitation of how far, high, and wide your company can grow. When you hire people that are far more capable of you than you, then they're going to bring in innovation and expertise that helps your business flourish. And most importantly, they help you design a business that flourishes without you. See, entrepreneurs can easily, because we're frugal in nature, we can easily become the hub. And even when we hire people, they're merely spokes in the wheel. But all the decisions keep coming back to the hub. So I end up as an owner having a business that's dependent on me. Ideally, you'd like to have a business that does not depend on you, that operates without you, a management team that provides, that can prepare a strategy without you. And so that puts you on a better glide path. If you can just do those four things, it'll put you in a better glide path. And so then, you know, when you're building a team, which is important, you build a team that is capable and is accountable.
Okay. So people who want to have a big exit, let's talk a little bit about your practice area in particular, which is exit planning. So this is people who have decided, yes, the point here is to build enterprise value, I guess, maximize that and have a day, right? A day in the sun. We'll talk about what happens to them afterwards or whether that was the right thing for them to do as people, but that's what their objective is. So typically, if you have someone coming to you saying, listen, I've decided I want to exit, how much horizon is optimal? Is this something you can do in 6 months, or is this something you should do 6 years in advance?
Well, it's not 6 months. Exiting a business is very dissimilar than selling a home. And many people think that they are similar. So they say, I'm going to wait until I'm ready to sell before I seek the advice of an exit advisor. And quite frankly, most businesses are going to take 12 to 18 months to sell. From the point that you decide you want to, it's probably 12 to 18 months before you execute and sign on the dotted line and cash changes hands. So 6 months isn't long enough. I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 year window, 4 to 6 year window, something like that. It really depends on the level of risk you have in your company and how much value do you need or want the company to provide for you. I always tell people that, you know, if you're a business owner over the age of 45, you probably should get a business assessment done so that you clearly know how much you need, what is your freedom to retire number, and how much your business is worth, and how attracted it is, and how ready it is. And once you can do those things, then you know. Because if you have customer concentration, it takes longer to lower the risk. If you have owner dependency, it takes longer to lower the risk. You can't just hire 5 people and automatically, 1 year later, you don't have owner dependence. That's just, it doesn't work that way. And so it's a journey, if you think about it, and it's no different than the journey you take to grow your business. So if you think about when you do exit planning, it's that point at which you want to grow your business. because that way you can ensure that you're growing a business in such a way that you're also growing the value of the business, not just the revenue, not just the income, because you can grow income and not grow value.
Yeah, okay, I get that. So when we talk about value, we're talking about what someone's willing to put down for the business at the end of the day, right? Someday. What I've started to understand is that oftentimes if you're an SMB owner, you know, you're going to exit, there's a reasonable chance that there's going to be a bigger company that's going to exit or going to purchase your business. And in order to do that, you need someone who speaks that language, because it's a very different language. My sister is in corporate world. She works for pharma, big pharma, very successful, PhD and MBA. And when she talks about business and I talk about business, it's a totally different language we're speaking. And she thinks I'm an idiot and I think she's an idiot. And of course, like every brother and sister should together, right? So we all think the other's being competitive. But I think that's actually worth SMB people understanding, that there is a bit of a chalk and cheese when you've come from corporate land and you're dealing now with what I would call the real world, right? Small business, medium-sized business. It's a different culture fit. And you need someone who's going to be able to speak that language when it comes to transitioning up, right? To understand what these people who, as far as I'm concerned, live in Mars, because it's a totally different experience. 20 years in corporate is totally different to 20 years working in SMB. And what would you say to that? Do you think it is all that different, or am I overplaying that?
Oh, dear. That's the age-old question. As much as it's different, it is similar. And here's what I mean. An SMB will have very similar problems, challenges, and opportunities that a larger enterprise has. They simply don't have the same amount of resources. So you may find yourself having a greater span of control when you're in an SMB than when you're in corporate environment. You are going to be required to understand more, do more. But if you've had a well-rounded career in a Fortune 500, you understand that you've done that and you've been there. So then it is not that big of a transition for you.
Okay, interesting. So let's take a worked example, right? So Q1 2025 is dead and in the ground. And as far as I'm concerned, it can stay there. It was horrible. It was home for me. So we had a terrible sales quarter. So look at this is my way to fix the problem. I'm buying books on sales all of a sudden. I'm trying to go, well, hold on, let's get that back in here. Let's start doing demos. Let's figure out what happened.
Yeah.
And that's the SMB approach, right? So you just get stuck in, you just try and fix it. How would corporate world approach that? Is it dissimilar? Would you just drive your salespeople harder, or would they bring in consultants? Or, I mean, give me a flavor of the different problem solving strategy here.
Well, first of all, let's not simplify SMB. Some SMBs will seek help because, you know, specifically if your challenge is sales, the solution may not be in selling, it may be in marketing. Great marketing makes it easier to sell.
Yeah.
The better your marketing is, the less amount of selling resources you need. So, you know, the SMB, just as a large corporate organization, may find themselves seeking outside advice. The great thing that's happened in SMB is the explosion of fractional work. So they can find a person that's going to roll up their sleeves and work with them, as opposed to a consultant that tells them what to do. So I think the SMB, those that seek external help, it's easier for you to do something different. When you diagnose a problem yourself, there's a temptation that you're going to keep doing the same thing over and anticipating, expecting a different outcome. And that's where the problem begins, because now you're operating in the world of insanity. Large companies, they probably first diagnose it internally, and then point to where they want external resources, because you have to remember, they have more internal resources than an SMB has or ever will have.
What do you end up advising? Let's say you take on a new client, and what are the go-to moves you have that as an SMB owner, you can see what's the biggest piece of advice you end up giving to people in order to be able to professionalize or get ready for an exit?
You know, I can't say that there's one piece of advice, but the first thing we always want a business owner to do is get a great understanding of their business today.
Right.
And that is, how does a potential buyer see my business today? So you have to remember, your business is like your baby. You have a tendency to see it a lot better than it is. You are the master of managing risk. So for you, the risk you see may not be the same as the risk that a potential buyer sees. You know, there are literally people that have a single customer, 60% of their sales is with that single customer, and they don't see a problem with it because they've been working with that customer for 20 years.
Sure.
But a prospective buyer sees that as a huge red flag.
Right. Interesting.
And so if you first say, okay, how is my business now? That is the platform in which you jump off of and say, what are the things I need to do today? It's based on that diagnostic of my business today from the eyes of a potential buyer. And because let's face it, your business is your baby and you just don't know when your baby's ugly.
Yeah, very true. It's hard to read the label from the inside. That's, you know, the expression.
And so then when you go into the engagement, you know, the focus areas are always going to be the organization, the dependencies, the cost, and the path in which you bring business in, and how do you prioritize the business. So everything we do will touch on that framework, but it's all about de-risking and growing the value.
Okay.
And the one thing I should really clarify is, I think I said earlier that you can grow your income and not grow your value. Income is the result of what you as the owner puts in. The value is the result of the business excluding you.
So to put a number on that, like, or to figure that out, if you took the entrepreneur out of the business and you saw what would break, then you say, well, that whatever broke, that value is coming from the entrepreneur, a person who does it, not the business itself. And that's what you got to test for. So how do you test that? Do you tell the entrepreneur, hey, take a sabbatical, head off for 6 months, come back, let's find out what's broken. We do a Doge approach here. We'll just go in and rip it all out and then see what breaks and come back.
There's some more obvious ways. And that is, you know, who's the MVP, the most valuable person in the eyes of the customer? So if 60, 70% of the customers were someone that was sold by the owner, then you know that the business doesn't have a selling process that's independent of the owner. Okay. Likewise, if a certain percentage of the work requires the owner to do it, their input, their advice to do it, then you know that you have a greater deal of dependency. If there's this constant wheel of questions that managers have to bring to the owner, so when you look at the processes, if that owner is still actively involved in decide, approve, then you know that organization is dependent on them.
Okay, so let's talk about approvals then, because you've rang a bell there, because Procurement Express, part of what we do is approvals. And actually, Q2 2025, we just rolled out a whole new approval system, which I'm unreasonably excited about. Actually, we showed it to our first couple of fractional CFOs last night, and one, Ben de la Cretas, he was like, I shouldn't be so excited about this, but I am. What I see is a big unlock is the ability, you might do your cash flow projection, and let's say you do a budget. Sometimes organizations are doing it for the first time. And then you've got to be able to actually deploy that, right? So actually, there's no point in having a budget if it still all goes back to the entrepreneur to decide on everything, right? It's got to be in the hands of the operations teams. And this is something I particularly enjoy working on with companies, because this is a, you know, a practical deployment of that. So what's your go-to tactic for getting the credit card out of the entrepreneur's grip, or whatever the equivalent is, stopping the centralization when it comes to finance and control? Like, what's your go-to method for sort of stopping the entrepreneur deciding, making all the financial decisions?
Yeah, great question. I think there's two methods, and doesn't matter how you do them. The first thing is you need to have an authority approval matrix.
Right.
That makes clear different people in the organization, what is their approval authority for this type of expense versus that type of an expense, and so forth. So that sort of says you have authority up to this level. You don't need me to make a decision. It's only when you exceed that level. The second part of it is to have folks responsible for a pool of cost and services and hold them accountable for achieving it.
Right. Okay, I love this. So when you say hold them responsible, how does that look? Let's say, let's take a worked example. So sales is too easy. Let's look at, say, operations. Let's say, let's go back to your hypothetical drum production business, right? Where someone's responsible for some cost within the business. How do you sit down and make them responsible? Do you put it as part of their compensation, or is it just more, do you make it more obvious? What's your very tactical approach to actually implementing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And any accountability needs a cadence of when you will review that.
Awesome.
And one of the things that we have to be a bit careful with is when we're transforming, growing, changing businesses, then we should have metrics that don't just measure what the outcome is, but it measures what the change in behavior you want that person's team to do, because that's what you're trying to keep track of. So literally when you say, I'm going to increase something, the next question is, let's talk about what are the steps you're going to take to actually deliver up on that. So then people began to think about, well, I need to do this many calls. Oh, but by the way, there's only a 10% conversion. Ah, but if I do this, I can change the conversion. And so they've walked through the math to say, I physically have to do this many calls per week, this many meetings per week, this kind of marketing per week. And therefore, they're reporting back on, did they do it? And what was the result of it?
Yeah, I love that. Well, that's what we call in our business leading indicators versus lagging indicators. So the leading indicator is the work you do in order to affect an outcome, right? So the sales is a lagging indicator, but the phone calls is the thing, the work you do, the number of phone calls that drives that, you know? And being able to lay that bare and clear, so it's sort of inarguable, is very powerful. You know, you can use your history. You can look at what's happened. That happened to us in Q1. That's why we had a terrible Q1. We did half the number of phone calls we did in Q4. Yep. Guess what? We had a third the amount of sales. There you go. So being able to draw that out. And it's exciting when you, I feel like this is the magic of a business. Like when you know that number, when you know the 10%, when you know, okay, you need this many calls to get that result. That's the sort of magic unlock, which is truly the value in the business. Because if you were certain about that number, anyone could go out and compete against you. But most people don't know that number, and you have to find it out the hard way normally. So,
yeah, you do. You have to understand that number, because one thing about that number, it is going to change.
Yeah.
As your business grows, it will change. Your conversion rate will increase, or it may decrease. But you need to understand how it is evolving.
Awesome. So let's wrap things up by asking a little bit about who's the ideal customer for you. Like, having listened to this, who should reach out to you and how can they do it?
Very good. So generally speaking, the ideal customer is someone that wants to change, grow, improve their business. If they're not, you are satisfied with your business, then chances are you may not need a CFO. You may only need a controller and a bookkeeper. The controller, the bookkeeper gives you a great deal of transparency on where you've been. And if you have no intentions on growing, changing anything, then that's all you need is to understand where you've been. The CFO is going to help you plot the path on how do you go from your current state to your aspirations. And so what we're looking for is business owners that have aspirations to change the state of being. They want to grow. They want to turn around and make an unhealthy business healthier, or they want to grow the value of their business. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that owner needs to be willing to accept advice or coachable. It's okay to be the smartest person in the room, but do you at least consider the voice of others?
Lastly,
is you have to be willing sometimes to take a step back before you can take steps forward.
Very interesting. Let me double click on that last point. What does that mean? Does that mean you have to temper your expectations of what's possible in the short term?
No. Sometimes you are doing garbage. Look. Right. We all take on products or do services under the auspices of, I don't have as much work as I'd like to have, or this is an entree into something bigger. But before you know it, it's grown a lot more than just providing marketing services. It's grown, it's become a part of the portfolio you offer, and it's not a very successful portfolio. So you may have to reprice that portfolio, and maybe as part of that repricing, some go away. Or you may say, you know what, I don't even want to do this anymore. I am having a hard time finding talented people, and I've got 10 people over here doing this service. If I could redeploy them into a higher value-added service, then I think I should just exit this part of the business.
Interesting.
Or something of that nature is really what I mean.
Great. And what's the best way for people to get in touch if this rings a bell with anyone listening?
Absolutely. You can always email me at d.cherry, like the fruit, at focuscfo.com.
Very good. Thanks, Darren, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And thank you for listening. If you're still listening, congratulations. Your special reward for getting this deep into the show with Darren and I is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, why would you want to do that? Do you sign up for newsletters? I don't. But let me give you a reason to sign up for this one. So I'll tell you a story about numbers. You love numbers, right? So about, you know, if we've been doing our newsletter for, let's say the latest version of it for about 2 years now, and what we would do is we put in, you know, interviews like this is going to appear in the newsletter, and we would put in some recent stories from the press or whatever, and maybe a service, a software service that you might want to use, maybe ours, maybe another one. And we were getting about a 20% open rate. And then we said, well, let's try and spice this up. And then good old Elon started causing trouble in Washington, D.C., and waste, fraud, and abuse became a thing. So we decided, hey, let's just review some of this week's most egregious waste, fraud, and abuse cases from SMBs, local governments, and NGOs, and put them in the newsletter, right? So, for example, last week or the week before, we had poor old Naomi Campbell. I don't know if you remember her. Her charity got caught up in flying their executives around first class when they should have been helping starving artists. We had a chap in Tennessee, I believe, who magicked out of thin air 400 employees that never existed in order to get 400 stimmy checks cut for him, and he's ended up in jail. And then we have local municipalities in the UK who've gone out of business because the finance team just weren't doing the day job. So we've got these basically car crash TV style stories that we've started putting in the newsletter. And I thought this is very embarrassing. This is very lowbrow. Our customers are way smarter than this. They're not going to read this stuff. Bam. Now we have a 40% open rate. Turns out lowbrow stories, there's a lesson in it for all of us. And in fact, if you don't want to end up in our newsletter as an example of a poorly managed financial SMB, then maybe you can learn a thing or two from the stories that we're going to share. So you can sign up at proprocurementexpress.com/newsletter. Once a week, high quality, well, maybe low quality, but fun stuff, stories that you can learn from, and maybe you can share with your clients as well. That's it. That's my outro. That's my pitch. That's my full sales mode there. You just experienced my full sales mode. I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks very much for being on the show.
Thanks, James.